Greetings, women. This is Shakti, and I'm so delighted to have with me on this call today Anaya Sophia, who many of you probably know. I feel almost like it's unnecessary to introduce her, but I'm going to do so. So Anaya is a mystic, an author, and an initiator of sacred marriage in the mystical teachings of the feminine Christ. She's a wellspring of both wisdom and experience and is known for her role in birthing new paradigm relationships, divine sexuality, and the awakening of the sacred body. And much of Anaya's work is really very focused on the feminine aspect of Christ consciousness, which comes through the tantric, virginal, and mystical expressions of Mary Magdalene and Mother Mary and the Black Madonna. So really such a powerful connection to the mystery traditions, which she has brought through in some really profound and exquisite books that are worth having a look at. The latest one, I think, being Divine Relationship. And then it includes books like Womb Wisdom, Sacred Sexual Union, and The Rose Knight. So welcome again, Anaya. So wonderful and such a delight to have an opportunity to interview you again.
Oh, likewise, Shakti. So beautiful to hear your voice again.
And what actually happened is that as I was introducing this course, Awakening Your Feminine Sexual Essence, at some point I posted something about who shaped your sexual self-image, which you women will know is one of the themes that we've been addressing in this course. And Anaya responded with quite a bit of enthusiasm in the idea of let's have a conversation about this theme. And women, just to remind you again that when we're talking in the way that we've been exploring the theme on the course, that it's interesting and valuable to just consider that our sense of ourselves as sexual beings has been influenced and shaped by our environment, by the people and the groups that have come into our lives over the years, and especially in our childhood, and that maybe have held a certain relationship with sexuality in themselves, have made certain demands as to how they wanted us to relate to our sexuality. And then, of course, how are they related to us as sexual beings? So all of those factors we've been exploring in the sexual mapping exercise, Anaya. So I do this exercise with a woman where they identify the key figures and groups that influence their sexual social identity. And then they create a map where they place all these different entities in relation to themselves on a map and connect them with different strings. And then they do some reflection on what they see in the map. And then there's a remapping exercise where they have an opportunity to actually reflect on whether this is the map that they want. You know, if we look at that statement that the map is not the territory, we actually have the opportunity to remap our sexual social self-image. And so then the women did a remapping where they decided what they wanted in the map. And that's, of course, very revealing. And I just know that this has been such a big, of course, journey of discovery for you in your own personal life and in your exquisite teachings. So I would love to have you share with us your journey with this and your discoveries. And I want to just start by reading what you wrote about it, which is so interesting because it speaks to your personal experience. So you said, I grew up in a very confusing environment. One parent was very sexual and the other was not. I could feel the tension between these poles and often wondered what it was. It was the erotic charge of the forbidden, the gigantic attempt to deny it, and the intense friction between the two. And I absorbed the whole lot. I was made in this friction, the sexual union of opposites. So beautiful. This aspect of life became my fascination and my greatest fear, and absolutely led to my awakening and embodiment. I feel it is time to truly and innocently explore our sexual image, how it got there. Who does it work for? Does it still serve us? And how true to this are we being? Beautiful, Anaya. So fascinating that you can look back and see how those two parents actually created this. It's so poetic the way you say that this friction actually created you in a way. It's the beginning of you.
Yeah, absolutely. I love what you were saying, Shakti, about this mapping. This is genius.
Yeah.
I love the sound of that completely. And as you were speaking, I was thinking, well, who was my big icon? And then I just laughed to myself because it was Madonna, which, of course, is,
right.
You know, the Madonna, the Mary, the Virgin. I'm like, oh, my
yes.
God. Even way back
wow.
then,
so
I
sense.
Was already plugging into that energy. Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so the way you described it, Shakti, is exactly the environment I grew up in. Two very charged energies. One of yes and one of no. And it's still here, to be honest. Like we were speaking this morning, you know, my work at the moment is this bringing forth of a very pure and very holy temple space for men and women, although the serpent, the erotic, is there, but it serves a deepening into your being so that you can release shame and grief. Sorry, not grief, but yes, that's in there as well. Shame and guilt, and all of those little icky places that you have been trying to avoid in that beautiful body of yours. And that it's just held at that impeccable level. And I often look at the Marys, you know, the statues of the Marys. They often have a bare foot stood on a serpent. And the Bible will say, yes, because they have squashed the erotic force. They do not allow this serpent energy to be. They are in charge. They are on top. Mm-hmm. And if you look closely, that serpent is not dead. Their eyes are always open, and the body is not dead. It is fat, it is vibrant, it is robust and gorgeous. For me, how I understand that is Mary has, yes, indeed, she has her foot over the serpent, but the serpent is very much alive. But the Mary, the priestess, has her foot on it like the gas pedal. So she knows how to release the lid, she knows how to put the brakes on, but she doesn't harm the serpent. And the serpent has been refined so that it actually serves that Mary. It serves her highest vision. And I do believe...
Beautiful, Anaya.
As I approach that beautiful 5-0, you know, my late 40s, I'm really getting close to be able to stand in that same way. But Shakti, it has taken my whole life to get to this place.
Exactly, and I think that's what would be so helpful maybe for the women and I, if we could reflect together on what that journey's been for you, you know. So, you know, I so often hear that from women. It's like, it feels overwhelming. Do they listen to somebody like you speaking like that and think, well, you know, she's just some miracle that came from somewhere. But of course, you're not just some miracle. You had your journey that brought you here. So can we go back to this fascinating story that you told about your childhood of these two parents? And how was that for you to have this one parent be so sexualized or pro-sexual and the other one to be so suppressed? What was your experience of that, Anaya, and your childhood?
At times, it was my father who was the sexual one. So at times, there was an innocent There was an innocent curiosity as I felt his energy shift, especially when we're watching movies together as a family or walking down the high street and he would be commenting on other ladies. But then that innocent curiosity kind of turned into a little bit of a sacred rage, because I didn't want my dad to speak in that way. And I remember it making me feel a little bit sticky, a little bit uncomfortable. And then, of course, yes. I would start to look to my mum for some sort of, like, feedback, some sort of response towards my father. And it just became, because my mum was doing a great job of denying everything around her. And so as I got a little bit older, I began to see the dynamic. One that started off very curious and innocent, and then turned into a little bit of a, well, not a little bit, it was quite an uncomfortable feeling after a while. But despite that, there was something in me that was also kind of naturally drawn. There was like an instinct to also explore, because my father couldn't really explore. He was a young father, he was married, but I wasn't. And so I believe I took on my father's explorative nature. And I'm like, so what was my dad interested in? And so I began to push open doors here and there in my teenage, especially in my 20s, once I moved to London. And I started to see what was behind the forbidden door. But when you see what's behind the forbidden door, such as your sensitive being, what you see and hear and feel tends to get embedded in your being. It starts to become part of your body. And of course, in hindsight, I can look back now and go, yeah, there was a little bit of a price to pay, you know, to get so enriched in a certain quality of life. But of course, that has been my entire spiritual work, to refine that part of me. So
I'm curious if you're when you say that, in that refinement and that journey of the curiosity that was connected to your dad and his interest in sexuality that he couldn't explore really because he was married, and but then there was also your mother that wasn't sexual and that was in denial. And I imagine that there's also been some process of alchemy for you in kind of finding the essence of what she was about.
Yes. Well, again, in my, you know, 10, 11, 12, 13 years old, I remember looking at my mum saying, I am not going to become that. There is no way I want to kill off my sexual self, although obviously I wasn't calling it those things at that time. I just knew that something was missing in mum. There was an emptiness, there was a void, there was a coldness. I mean, her heart is beautiful, you know. As a family, we were very, very intimate. But I could feel that sexual part was over. And we're talking a lady in her early 40s. That's kind of like our age. So I'm like, oh, no.
Yeah.
I'm not ready for that yet. And so I remember clearly understanding two things from my parents. One was the curiosity that I took from dad, and the other was the deciding factor, whatever this energy is, I got to keep it alive somehow. And so again, you know, through that beautiful polarity of two opposing forces, I cultivated the third voice, my voice. I am interested, that is true, and I want to keep it alive. But it's got to be clean, be down the middle.
Right. Yeah, and so in when I'm imagining the mapping and those two figures in your map and the elements that you've introduced as being your mother and your father there and then you, it's almost as though they created this force or this tension that created the environment for you to be shaped and then to become who you are now. But your sexual self-image didn't just stay with that, it got developed further. So you developed a relationship with those primary influences or that were there initially. And then you started to really cultivate your sexual self-image. And how did that happen? Can you say something about the process of that, of developing a conscious, individuated relationship with your own sexual self-image?
I think the first part of my sexuality couldn't really flower until I'd left home because of the tension. This kind of like this Lilith character, this rebel, really wanted to show herself. But she knew, oh my God, if I do that with Dad around, this is not going to be good. So I kind of like sat on that until I'd left home. And of course, I was an only child. There was no backup. It was, if I wanted to rise up and be rebellious, there was no older brother or sister to take the heat with me. It would be one of those moments when you do it all by yourself. And I'm like, no, forget it. I'm going to wait till I've left home. So in my early 20s, I moved to London and the wild cat came out. And that's where I saw, not so much partook, saw very blatant taboo sexuality in the club scene. You know, weird and wonderful things going on in my home because, you know, there's a couple of us who share the same house. It was wild. But I was always a little bit of, not a voyeur, like, oh, I'm watching and no one knows that I'm watching. It was more like I would, like, stumble across things. I'd walk into a room, oh, sorry, excuse me, but it's too late. I have seen everything. And I'm a very visual person. When I see, I see, and it goes in deep. And I was just playing around with everything. My sexuality, who am I, what am I, what do I represent, what do I enjoy? And I remember there was one moment when I was actually dating a transvestite man who was wanting to become a woman. and bless him, he began to fall in love with me, so much so that he questioned whether he wanted to go through with the operation. Something happened that night. We went out dancing in London. And I walked home that night, and I laid in bed, and I said to myself, Julie, because that's my first name, Julie, you're going a little bit too far with all of this. And I remember a little candle going on in my sacred heart, you know, like a reminder of the Christ, and I just knew, this phase is over. And I quit. I just cut with all those highly sexualized friends, and I simply didn't go out with them anymore. And then, you know, it really was a turning of the page in the book. And I remember that moment. I'm literally reliving it right now. It was a very
feeling it was huge
moment. And so
and
after
what
that,
came
there
next
was
thing?
Sorry?
No, I'm just curious what came next. It sounds like we're about to meet the next level of what shaped your sexual self-image.
What did come next? I think a balancing point. A balancing point and a maturing. Definitely a settling down. I settled down more into myself. The urge to shock and be rebellious had simply extinguished itself. It's like, okay, I have rebelled enough now. It's all getting very confusing. And and my being is not settled. You know, this is not true. This, I wasn't using the word holy back then, but I remember using the word goodness. It's like, no, I am straying a little bit too far from my inner light.
Right.
And so I brought myself back to center. And I think
I'm just reflecting on, you say that, you know, that it's I feel it's time to truly and innocently explore our sexual self-image, how it got there, what does it work for, who does it work for, does it still serve us, and how true to this are we being? You know, and I'm just really hearing, Anaya, as you share your fascinating story, that how that happened for you, right there. So there you were in your childhood home where your sexuality was held in this particular tension between your parents, and you couldn't really explore it. And then you left home and you were in London and you had a time where you really explored it. And it sounds to me like your sexual self-image changed significantly, and you maybe developed one that was exploring the freedom to do whatever the hell you wanted to do sexually, which is very interesting to have a look at, because I know that for many women, there's either an idealization of that, like, oh, if only I could find the freedom in me to just go and do anything I want to do sexually, then I will be free. Or there's a place in many women where there's a kind of a stuck relationship with that rebel. You talked about it as a rebel, and a sexual rebel that actually is in reaction to the constraint. And I can hear in the way that you're speaking about it that you also found that the rebel is actually, it's just the other side of what constrained it. So there isn't actual real freedom in it. But it might be a very necessary and valuable part of our process of finding our who we are and who we want to be in our sexuality.
Yes. What's interesting, Shakti, is you probably know this little story, but when I was 7, I saw, I met a beautiful being on the steps of Sacre Coeur, and I had like this Christ moment or angelic moment. And a very good warm feeling appeared in my heart and it stayed there. Now, as we talk now, I'm realizing, of course I have realized in the past, but it's coming through to say this to you again, my experimentation happened in the gay scene. This is a very safe place. It's extremely sexual, but that sexual energy is not coming in my direction, thank God. But there is a celebration. You know, if you are a woman in the gay scene, there's often a huge encouragement to really bring your feminine out. They want to see it. They love it. They adore it. And so I was like, yay, great. And there was no hits on me. Although I must say, towards the end of my time in that scene, I too was starting to bend. You know, it's like, am I gay? Am I lesbian? Am I bisexual? Wow, I seem to be dating a transsexual. And that's what I mean by it's really started confusing now. And that's what I mean by that night, my little heart lit up again in the memory of that man that I saw when I was 7 years old. And my inner compass sort of pointed towards that moment on the steps in Paris as a kid. And I went, enough. I've done my thing.
Wow. And what came next for you then, Anaya? So in terms of what shaped and who shaped your sexual self-image, were there other influences, whether they be in the body or being, you know, maybe disembodied beings, or what if you think back, or maybe even it comes to today, what came next in your journey?
what came next was, because obviously by the time I leave the gay scene, I'm pretty confident. You know, mm-hmm. I don't need to wear much. I'm confident. You know, I have this sexual identity now. So my next move was definitely to take that same being into the straight clubs.
Yes, right.
It wasn't. There's a part of me that says, this is not the desired effect. And of course, there's another part that goes, hang on a minute. Now there's some forward moving energy and it's coming in my direction.
Right.
But it was quite a lot. And it scared me to death because I couldn't behave the same. You know, the way I was dancing in the gay clubs, on the podiums, you can't do that in a straight club. Well, you could, but...
Mm-hmm.
So
right,
quickly,
very different scenario.
Tone it down, tone it right down.
Mm.
And I do remember a sadness, actually, because I wanted to carry on being that free being that I was in the gay scene. And simply realizing you just cannot be that. Not in London,
yeah.
Not in the 90s, not now. And so that part of me had to come in and not withdraw as in suppress, but wait patiently for another cycle. And I sort of believe that this cycle, this reappearance of that part of me, has shown itself again in the last years. But it's been married now with A, maturity, B, beautiful sacredness, and you know what happens when you've been on the path 30 odd years.
Yeah, wow. And so if you look at your life at this moment in time, with all this maturing that's happened over these last 30 odd years, what would you say, if you had to answer that question now, who now shapes, or who or what now shapes your sexual self-image? It's more fine to actually even articulate, Anaya.
I would say nature and the world of enchantment shapes my sexual self-image now.
Mm.
I have a very warm, warm is too hot, so there is a warmth that I feel when I'm in nature. To me, nature is not trees and grass and flowers. Nature, to me, are living beings that are giving off a radiance that you can play and dance with. And so, in fact, this is quite true. As I speak, I'm realizing this. If I want to dress to delight someone, I want to dress to delight nature. I want to walk into a forest and say, hey, you recognize me? I'm one of you.
Beautiful.
I must say, yeah, nature and the animal kingdom feature so strongly in my everyday life and in an interior world. I'm not dressing to impress humans anymore. I want to blend and become like nature, like the movie Avatar.
Yeah, beautiful. Wow.
That's so beautiful.
Beautiful. I so get you on that, and it's so inspiring to hear. And I also happen to know that you've got this beautiful man in your life. I wonder whether he's at all influencing your sexual self-image. Have there been any changes in your perception of yourself as a sexual being through being with him?
I don't feel it's shown itself on the outside. But definitely it is changing on the inside. This is our number one conversation, Shakti. I mean, even this morning we were talking about it. It is a constant theme and energy in our lives every single day. And always a refinement process. Always, you know, asking this question, what am I accessing here and what is it serving? And then, of course, comes the second question, no, really. Really, what is it serving? And that's right. What I mean at the beginning of the conversation. This temple work is like climbing on the back of a dragon and trying to figure out how to ride this beast.
Sure, yeah. Wow.
Interior alchemical process going on between Pete and myself and our sexual union. Who are we? Really, who are we?
Beautiful.
How are we using sexual energy? Are we still, you know, hooking and dancing and are there leakages here and there? Or you know, this is our number one conversation. And, of course, I'm in that later stage of life now, you know. The mother in me is diminishing. The mystic is coming into the foreground. So there's going to be a change. There has to be. There simply has to be a physical change as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what I'm hearing in the way that you're speaking about how you and Peter are relating, Anaya, is that actually there is a shaping of your sexual self-image of each other that's happening in that relating, but it's happening more as a question and as a state of vulnerability and a state of openness and receptivity to what is appearing now. So that instead of this dynamic that comes usually from our childhood where we're kind of like put into particular molds, you know, and as, like, for instance, when you say your father, it sounds like he had a particular strong sexual self-identity, which he wasn't, or self-image, which he may not have been that aware of, but he was living it, and so did your mother. And you were in between the two of them in a place where there wasn't really that much movement. It was kind of like a particular identity. You were the child of a parent who was sexual and a parent who wasn't. And I think it's like that for most people, is that we grow up in contexts where those identities that people around us have in relation to their sexuality are pretty fixed and rigid and unquestioned. Yeah. And then the ones that we form are also like that. And what we're talking about now, what you're articulating is happening in your life, is a relationship with sexual self in which becomes a deep inquiry rather than a kind of a form which in itself starts to create falsity. So if we, you know, like for instance, if somebody develops an idea that, okay, now I've reached the place where I am a very sexy woman and I'm very attractive and I've got this down and I know how to do this, then that in itself also becomes a rigidity, because we now become a thing, a something, a somebody that's got a particular shape. Whereas what you're talking about is that constant aliveness of who am I now, what's showing up, the vulnerability of engaging each other with everything that opens up in the process of being so present with your sexuality. Beautiful.
Yes. I just want to share with you this fantasy that I shared with Pete this morning. So I have this fantasy, Shakti, and I got a funny old feeling it's going to get lived because it's been there for like years. I have a fantasy of welcoming in a beautiful circle of ladies, all ages, all shapes, all sizes, all traditions. And I've made myself this kind of like black, scaly cat suit, which is a little bit like a little bit like a lizard or a dragon, and I've got some cloven feet, and I have this huge snake, and So I dance the dance of Lilith. I mean, I really go for it, but I'm very inclusive of all the women. So I'm not doing it to show off. I'm not doing it to compare and contrast, and I'm certainly not doing it to threaten. I'm doing it to totally delight them with fire. But what I want them to also see is I want them to see my crinkly, joyful Christ eyes. And to me, if I ever saw that, if I ever saw a lady totally embodying her Lilith and so obviously in her Eve at the same time, I would get down on my knees and pray and say, Hallelujah. And I want to welcome ladies into that environment and say, okay, I've done my thing, now let's do yours. And the whole thing is welcomed and celebrated, and we don't have to do Lilith by becoming that exiled one that we think we have to be in order to do her or to become her.
Yeah. Beautiful, beautiful.
She's going to live.
I want to actually tell you a little story about my experience of that, because it speaks to some of my explorations of the theme as well. I did something like this some years back. Gosh, it must have been 8-9 years ago already. I had a group of women, and we were actually exploring this theme that we're talking about now, but looking more specifically at this place where we've come from, where the split happened between the virgin and the whore and the sacred and the sexual in our collective self-image as women. And the change in the understanding of what the snake is and who the snake is, from being the symbol of the goddess herself to becoming the symbol of the devil. And so what I did was, we had this event in a very beautiful garden, in a cottage that was in this beautiful garden, and I had a friend of mine who actually had a beautiful boa constrictor snake. A rather large snake. She brought the snake along. And what happened is, we started to chant in the space, and suddenly heard this knock on the door. And the keepers opened the door and called me in, and they said, you know, this is a house of the Lord, and we don't allow this kind of sound that you're making now in this house. Yes. So I said to them, you know, I'm a Christian as well. You know, I'm totally into Christ and Mary. And they said, no, you actually have to leave. And so here we went, all these women, and with our snake, and got in the cars and started to drive to a new venue. And I told the women to all, while they were in the car, just to actually just vent all their anger at patriarchy. So they were all screaming in the car on the way to the new venue. We got to the new venue, and when we got there, we took the snake out, the boa, and we had the most exquisite experience of letting the snake run across our bodies. And I first demonstrated how I let this happen in my body. You know, you can imagine, like, that snake running over your crown chakra. It's like, incredible. And then all the women tried it, and we just had such a beautiful, like, you know, reclaiming celebration of the sacredness of our desire and our femininity. And there's something about that kind of imagery that we're talking about here, which also brings in a different possibility, Ananya, like shaking up these rigid self-images that we may have developed.
Yeah.
Maybe that's another way we can do it, is through these images, these stories, these imaginings of different possibilities.
Yeah. Beautiful story.
I thought you would enjoy that, because it kind of speaks to your fantasy there.
Yes. And of course, you know, Shakti, the men also have this quandary, you know. They also have a sexual polarity. I often call it the Pan and the Christ, or the Pan and the Krishna. So they do have this horned, hairy, extremely sort of horny sexual being. And of course, they also have the sacred, you know, a devotional desire to just infuse that lady with their gorgeous bhakti love.
Yeah.
And they too have that little schism of, who am I supposed to be? Why not be both? Yeah.
Yeah, and integrate the two.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What always feels a little bit strange to me, I noticed that when beings sort of make their way towards Lilith and Pan, it's like the personality hardens, can harden and become sort of mean and cruel. But I don't think that's what those beings are.
Right.
I believe what patriarchy has told us those beings are.
Yes.
You know, if you want to play with that energy, then you have to become like this. And I'm like, I don't think so. I am sure. I mean, Pan is extremely sexual and horny and a wordlessly erotic, but I bet he's got crinkle. Twinkle. There's a twinkle in
those eyes.
Yeah.
All the twinkles
you're
are
scared
full of
nature.
Go ahead, Anaya.
Oh, no, I was going to say, but if you're scared of Pan, you won't check. You won't be able to find out if he's got crinkly eyes or not, because you'll just run in the opposite direction.
Mm-hmm.
But those who are brave enough will get close enough to go, aha.
Yeah. And I think what I keep hearing in what you're sharing is the integration of both. Is the Pan with the twinkly eyes? Is the Lilith that is also that Mary Magdalene? I mean, she's such an embodiment of that integration, isn't she? Of the woman that's fully in the. In the wisdom, in the connection with her divine essence, and opening up such channels in the communion with the beloved Christ, and then at the same time she's a fully sexual embodied being that actually expresses part of what Christ is about, which is the embodiment of our divinity all the way into our sexuality. But it's almost like through her, that's how it really. How it really manifests.
Yes. I remember Andrew Harvey talking about Yeshua and Mary, and he posed the question, do you think Yeshua, Jesus and Mary were sexual? And he just roared. And he said, of course they were sexual. How on earth do you think they could live out the passion, the crucifixion? As if it couldn't have been sexual energy totally holding and supporting and sustaining that alchemy. Can you feel? If we imagine them as celibate beings going through the passion, that's one type of energy. But if you imagine them as sexual embodied beings, now Yeshua is fully able to take on that full initiation from toe to crown. Of course they were sexual. And not even just like middle of the road sexual. Powerfully sexual. Yeah, that's what.
Yeah, such a different possibility when we start to connect to the real in that is behind these religious constraints that have so shaped such a lot of our sexual self-image for so many people. Certainly I'm sure you find that too, Anaya. So many women I speak to deeply influenced by some or other form of religious upbringing that had them just cringe at the idea of even being a sexual being. so much complexity that religion has brought into our relationship with our sexuality.
Yes. Yeah, it's quite a process
to
reclaim that part of you again. And it is a tumultuous journey because by its very nature it's bound to be. But I always say, go in, claim your sexual self. It's going to be wild, it's going to be messy. Then there's going to be a sense of grief and loss and sorrow, and then you will swing back into balance.
Yeah, that does sound true, hey? And I think it's just good to know along the way that if we can hold the new identities that may surface as we kind of shake loose from the old one, if we can hold them lightly and not be so serious about them, right? Because otherwise we start to just flip from one opposite to the other, and we get very seriously identified with them, which then makes it more difficult to be in the kind of constant renewal of what's possible. I don't know how that sounds to you. Maybe we have to be serious about it at times, eh? and hold it more tightly.
I love the way the indigenous people speak about sexuality. They laugh at us Westerners getting all entangled and hooked up on everything. And they really just see it as something natural. It's natural. It's like, you know, it's like harvests and forests and sunshine and moonlight. It's so natural. It's so easy. We have definitely complicated things, but maybe that's because of the schism, you know, in the religions. Whereas the indigenous people, they didn't have to live that. It was always welcomed. It's natural. It's normal. It's gorgeous. You do it to celebrate things. Yeah, I think if we look towards the indigenous people, we will learn very wise things.
Yeah, it resonates with our own experience. But as you say, it's this journey that is actually quite messy. It's a human journey of discovery and finding ourselves as we go along and explore different possibilities, find more freedom. It's not something that we just decide, oh, I'm not going to be this anymore, now I'm going to be something else. We keep discovering more dimensions of who we are. And I know, I wonder if there's anything else that you wanted to share on this topic, or that you feel like exploring about this topic of how our sexual self-image was shaped and whether it still serves us and how true we are being to who we imagine ourselves to be.
I don't feel anything inside of me, Shakti, unless you have another little something on the back.
Just for some reason, I feel like asking you if you have any questions to me. I feel like turning the tables for a moment.
Yes. I would like to ask you, nothing's coming. I'm trying to make a question come. I don't think I do have something. I love the story you've shared with me. That gives me an insight into more of your nature. I always feel that we come from the same place, a similar place.
Exactly. That's also why I shared it, because it was actually such a beautiful moment for me of seeing how, you know, we live these apparently very different individual lives, and yet how richly we share some of the same deep archetypal story material, because we actually all do come from the same place. And That's actually a beautiful place to come to in the conversation, Anaya, isn't it? If we start to see these deep, mythical threads that run through our individual stories, and
yeah.
if we can start to relate to them with more imagination, more possibility.
Actually, the way that we're connected.
Yeah.
I do have a question. Mysteriously appeared. What gift, now, where you are now as a woman, what is the deepest gift you can give a man?
Wow. From where I am now, what is the biggest gift I can give a man? Ooh, that's a big question.
Yeah.
Well, I noticed that my body responds to that question. There's this kind of sense of an opening and a awakening, like a kind of shaking, like champagne bubbles that's happening in my body. And when I listen to my body, and it feels like the biggest gift I can give a man is to be in this beautiful body, fully open,
yeah.
and available to listen, in every dimension of my being, to his being. So in that way, to receive him as fully as I can, and in the subtlety of what's there in the meeting. So as to really find where it is that we're meeting, because I'm just more and more discovering that there's so many different dimensions of intimacy in life. And, you know, there are those intimate meetings where we will become lovers and have deep journeys together that will be very unique and held within a very specific container that keeps going deeper and deeper. But there are other forms of intimacy that may look like a once-off conversation, or may look like eye contact, or may look like a conversation with a dear friend's partner, or with a teacher, or an older man, or my brother's son. Different intimacies that show up in all these connections.
Mm.
And I find myself also just being deeply curious.
Yes.
To listen in a way that the listening from my body makes a space for the man to discover themselves more and to show up more as who they are.
Mm.
Yeah, now my body's really like vibrating with aliveness. Thank you for your question.
Yeah. Thank you, Shakti. I'm learning from you.
How would you answer that question? What comes to you?
What gift would I, the biggest gift I could give a man? I would like to pray over a man for him. I would like to lay him down and just pray over him.
Mm.
And pray for him, sincerely pray for him. Not that there's anything wrong with him. There's a part of me that just wants to just show that sacred heart, just show that devotion. Expose that devotion.
Oh. So beautiful, Anaya. I feel such a vast space opening up when you say that. So much can happen in that space. And it's like stepping through, if we come back to where we began this conversation, that tight place that you grew up in, of this
yeah.
pressure between these conflicting forces. And somehow when you move into that devotional state that you're talking about, it's like you slip right through the cracks, through the eye of the needle,
yeah.
and you're in a different zone where everything is so present in this moment that time doesn't even exist. And there is nobody that's doing anything, and yet everything is fully felt. And yeah, such a magical place to come to. Which is actually, isn't it, the dropping away actually of whatever identities, whatever clothes we were wearing, just fall off in that movement.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Beautiful, Anaya. Well, thank you so much for this really delicious, exciting conversation with you. And please just share with the women, how can they find out more about you and your work, and is there anything you'd like to mention to them about what you're up to?
Well, you can stay up to date on my website, which is my full name, AnayaSophia.com. And what I'm working on now is one of my deepest passions, and that's to actually open up temple spaces. Wherever Pete and I go, a beautiful, holy, sensual sanctuary where men and women can come and actually receive that quality of sacred touch like we did aeons ago, back in the day when the temple was amongst us. And that's my sincere and warm welcome. It's come on in. You're welcome. It's here again. Just drink from this source.
Sounds so beautiful, Anaya. Thank you so much for that and for the beautiful work that you do in the world. It's such a blessing to have your presence in my life and have you share so beautifully and so richly with the women on this course.
Thank you,
appreciate
Jackie.
Your time.
I love you so much. I so do. Thank you for your time. I know we've never met in person yet. Yeah. Big connection with you.
Definitely. And with Pete as well, hey? I feel him so with us whenever we're speaking.
Absolutely. He's just across the table, tapping away on his computer.
Oh, give him all my love.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Anaya.
Thank you, Jackie. God bless.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.